Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Robert clap.
Did you clap, Robert?
Yeah, I mean, I clap. There'll be a few there.
Okay.
2 hours later.
I definitely clap.
The first one's in there. Don't worry. You'll the audio cue's there.
Take it away, Battle.
Okay, Andre, edit my voice for this. Make it sound scary. Don't edit my voice, guys. I think you're not going to make it sound scary. You're going to make it sound stupid.
Boopy.
You're going to edit my voice, but...
Anyway, hey everyone, it's Battle, and this is We Are Bro is a murder. We talk about true crime cases of color and bring you music from artists you probably have never heard of before.
And today...
We were in Cosmo Bay.
I'm now a cosmopolitan.
Stay out of my DMs, thanks.
got them good sex tips.
Yeah.
It's me. I am Sex in a City.
Yeah, when I found out I could not work, I stopped working, and I was in a meeting. Andre called me, and he called me twice, and I told him before, if you call me twice, I'm going to answer it because I'm going to think it's an emergency. He's like, it's not an emergency, but guess what? Go to my Facebook. We made Cosmo. I was like, bitch, okay. I said, I'll call you back after, and I called him back, and he didn't call me back after he said he was going to call me back.
Because I was on the phone.
And I was giving Melinda so much shit. I was like, I've been getting so many DMs from everyone, and like, we need to. I might have to like leave you for another celebrity. Sorry.
So, yeah, you're not my clout bastard anymore.
And she just rolled her eyes and said, "Bitch, go make me some dinner because I've been at work all day." I'm like, "Yes, man."
Yeah, she already secured a bag. She got a whole kid. You ain't going nowhere. She got you for 18 years at least.
You about to pay what you owe.
I had random ass people hit me up on Snapchat, actually, which was cool. Like, I went to high school with or whatever, but...
Yeah, no, I had some old flames from my little black book hit me up. I was like, how you been? I was like, No. Don't do that. Don't embarrass yourself.
I didn't have anybody hit me up.
Kind of hidden on social media. Well, on Facebook,
yeah.
At least.
Yeah, on Facebook.
And but welcome to the spooky month, the spookiest of months, other than, I don't know, what's another really scary month?
Another scary month?
April. Yeah. It's April.
I was thinking April, too.
Why?
I don't know why.
Why is April scary?
Oh, ooh. I think December.
Yeah, because it's like dark and cold.
No, because the holidays... And what we do around the holidays and how we pretend to like each other and then buy each other gifts. And the day after the holidays ends, we start to be crazy again and be like, what is this? This gift? Oh my gosh, I'm going to return it. Why didn't I get a gift receipt? That's why I don't fucking buy presents. I am the Scrooge.
Andre, did you read Friday Black?
I did.
It has some spooky holiday stuff in it, too.
We should have, like, a book club, honestly.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Who got time to read?
Audiobooks, babe.
Oh, fair.
I love audiobooks.
Me and my ADHD, that's the Gob of War right there.
The Glob of War?
The Gob of Ghoul.
I'm 16% Italian, so, you know, I get it.
Oh my gosh, stop.
3%.
I'm like an eighth Native American. You know how much I hate when people say that?
Yeah,
it's like, okay.
It's like, first off, you're probably not.
Like, okay.
So yeah, this is Spooky Month, and we're going to give you spooky content all month. Now, the episode before this was the witches one. Pretty sure that's going to be out.
What?
No, you guys are, I didn't think that out of order. I didn't put out the witches one for a minute, so I was going to put it out before this one, because I was like, oh, I never used this, actually. It's just sitting in my drive. So, right now...
Sorry.
Stand battle.
I don't know what it is. We're like especially stupid today.
It's the morning.
Too early.
But yeah, so all this month, well, the rest of the month, we're going to be doing serial killers. And this is our first episode. And so who wants to take it away first?
Okay, I'll go.
I'll go first.
Okay.
No, that's go not. Ahead. Robert, gonna go,
no, yeah,
Robert,
no,
go
no,
first. Get Robert, that. Go first.
It's cool. Today, we're talking about Kaboni Savage and the Savage Drug Ring. So needless to say, the leader of the Savage Drug Ring is Kaboni Savage. It's his last name. When I was first reading about it, I'm like, oh, like, where does his name come from, the Savage Drug Ring? Because I thought it was because they're, like, super brutal or something. It's like, no, just his last name.
That's, like, actually his real name? Because it sounds like...
Kaboni Savage, yeah. Real name. Yeah, it definitely sounds like a fake name, but it is... His legal name, all the court documents are all the Savage versus...
When I tell people my name is Battle, they're just like, is that real? I'm like, yes, it is real.
I know, it's such a cool name, though.
Look at
we have 90. The war names. You're Battle, I'm Hunt. Kill some people. No, just kidding.
I know.
Not really NSA.
So... Kaboni Savage is from Philadelphia. He was born in 1975. He was originally a boxer. He only had one professional fight, though. He did win, but he was, like, training to be a boxer. But he's from the inner city, so the way he found to make money was by running drugs. In the area of Philly that he was, he had locked down one corner, essentially, with his accomplices in this drug ring. And... because he was known for being a very violent, brutal person, they didn't really have much competition, and they made a ton of money. And they were people who, you know, because this was like the early 80s, they were one of the first people to like do stuff like cutting drugs to like increase volume and stuff like that. And they had a bad reputation, but that doesn't really matter when you sell drugs because people will still buy from you.
Hey, they got a piece of shit, but...
yes, I say. They're cutting this kilo in half to double their profit, but I'm still gonna buy it.
I'm still, hey, it's local.
But there was one incident that kind of messed up all of his money. Kaboni Savage was pulling into a parking spot, and somebody else was trying to pull in at the same time, and they bumped his car. And people out on the scene of the crime said, like you couldn't see any damage, like it really wasn't that big of a deal. But Savage got out of his car, and they got into an altercation. And he turned around in front of this, like, block full of people that were all just kind of, like, hanging out. And he asked, like, does anybody know this guy? And they said, nope. And he pulled out a gun and he shot him. Like, he got everyone's attention, asked them a question, and then responded by murdering this man.
I just want to make sure I have as many witnesses as possible.
Yeah. The man he shot was Kenneth Lassiter. Now, Kenneth Lassiter was a foot soldier for another drug kingpin. I don't know. He ran another block. His boss was Tip Flowers, who coincidentally was also a small-time boxer / drug enforcer. So that kind of started their beef. Apparently there was also some history with them where there was a PCP deal that went bad between the two. But as a result of this murder of Kenneth Lassiter, Tib, turned informant to put Savage away. Later, when he was kind of questioned about, like, why did you become a rat? Like, you were a drug kingpin. Like, that's really not what you're supposed to do. Like, that's not street code stuff. He said, because of the murder of Kenneth Lassiter, because of the murder of Kenneth Lassiter, there were cops on his block constantly who were trying to, like, solve this murder, so it shut down his business. So he said the only way he could retaliate against Savage was to put him in prison. So he testified and put him in prison. Tim would be later picked up, so they would be in prison during the same time, which is where kind of Savage became famous. He is now kind of used as the textbook example of witness tampering because he killed people from prison. He is said to have killed these people from prison because he was ordering hits from his gang on people who were going to testify against him or against his businesses. He was essentially shot caller, but the person on the outside who's doing all of his business was his younger sister, Kadada Savage. And he also had Lamont Lewis and Eugene Coleman and Robert Merritt to a lesser degree, who were all members of his gang who, you know, would murder people and continue to, you know, put money in his commissary and, you know, operate his business while he was on the inside. This kind of revenge he was trying to seek from Tim grew to the point that he ordered a firebombing on his family's house.
His family?
His family, yeah. And the firebombing was, I guess you could say, successful. It killed 6 people, 2 adults and 4 children. And all of this was conducted from inside the prison, through prison mail, through phone calls. And if you know anything about prison, all of those are monitored.
So is there an inside cop or detention officer? Excuse me.
So, no, they eventually found out all of this. Like, they pulled the records and, like, oh, so he was orchestrating this so we can prove he did it. But I guess there was just no one listening at the time to, like, warn these people or to stop it from happening.
What?
Which is very strange to me.
Yes.
By the time he went to...
You mean the cops weren't doing their jobs?
Surprise.
Ain't that a bottom line?
So Kaboni Savage would go up on charges for all of these murders. It ended up being 12 people, I believe, total. And also, when I was, like, doing research for this, I started to think, like, who is volunteering to be on that jury? Like, this we're charging this man for witness tampering and killing people. And you're going to want me to convict this person in the city that I live? Like, that's horrifying. And I know he's got people on the outside, and it can't be that difficult to find someone off jury duty. He ended up getting 13 life sentences, and he was the first and only person to be sentenced to death in Philadelphia federal court. He's still awaiting his death sentence. The two men that were contracted to do the firebombing were also arrested. And if anyone is interested, you can go listen to the wiretaps from the prison phone.
Ooh, really?
Some of them are a little, you know, gross and sad. Like, he talks about, like, wanting to physically hurt, like, very young children.
Wow.
Because he knew Flowers had children. So he talked about, like, oh, I want to, like, beat one of them to death with a bat. Like, stuff like that.
Jesus.
So, if not for the faint of heart. But, yeah, Kaboni Savage, got 12 murders to his name, most of which happened while he was in prison, under his orders.
Could you imagine having that much pull on people towards, like, hey, I need this done, knowing that, like, the person that's in charge has 13 life sentences, which I don't understand. I don't understand sentencings or sentences to begin with that much, like, as far as, like, would one life sentence suffice? People that are listening, please actually come to my DMs and explain that to me, because I want to understand, like, how does life...
Well, because it's like 25 to life. So, like, say, like, if you get a life sentence and it's only 25 years, that's really, in the scheme of things, not that much.
Survivable.
Yeah, like...
Well, and, like, if they do any appeals, I think you can appeal, like, specific crimes or something.
Could you go...
So, like, if they don't do all of them...
Could you not have a life sentence with no possibility of an appeal or, like, a parole? So does
you
that
always it's a constitutional right for an appeal, but yeah, you can get it without parole.
Okay, I see. Oh, that makes sense then, why they have consecutive life sentences.
Yeah, But the thing, though, is it's like, too, like, with some people, because I remember this one case where this guy got, like, 256 years in prison. It's like, is it really justice if it's, a term that they'll never actually serve? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Right. I will also say Kadada Savage, his younger sister who helped orchestrate everything, also received a life sentence for the role she played in the arson murder.
That's crazy.
Yeah. It's really interesting because your case is very similar to my case. I did my case on Cleman Johnson, who went by Big Evil. He was a part of one of the, like, many...
I think nickname.
Yeah. He was part of one of the many, like, subgroups of the Bloods. And it was a lot of the same stuff where he... orchestrated like 4 deaths while he was in prison, something like that, and then an attempted murder. And he was one of those people where like he would kill people and like get off because he was so good at like, you know, intimidating witnesses and things like that. So he was born October 15th, 1967 to Aileen and Cleman Johnson and had loving parents and 4 brothers, 2 half-siblings and 2 full brothers. He grew up in a nice 3-bedroom home with a large porch on the 88th Street neighborhood of LA. And he was a Boy Scout. But despite growing up in a loving family, he grew up right in the middle of the burgeoning gang violence in LA, and the fighting became deadlier through like the 70s. So when he was 8 years old, he watched a bunch of teenagers kill one of his friends right in front of him. So like within a few years, he was part of the I guess he had his own gang when he was a teenager called the 88 Monsters, and then eventually became part of the 89 Family Bloods, which I guess the numbers correspond with like the streets that they lived on, which is a thing. Yeah, that's a thing that I was learning when I was reading about all the gangs in LA, where it's like their biggest identifier is like what street they live on, because it's all based on their neighborhood. Yeah. And so he was one of those people like that you didn't really mess with. He was a good fighter from even when he was a teenager, and by the time he was in his like late teens, early 20s, the 89 Family Bloods was considered one of the deadliest gangs in the city, especially considering how small they were. He was described by law enforcement as being more thoughtful than like other people who ran in gangs. So like most people are like very reactionary, like, you know, you shoot us, we shoot you.
Yeah.
But he would like plan out like coordinated attacks on other people. Yeah.
One thing, I was watching this show called Gangland. It's like,
I love that show, but I used to get so scared. It's good. I think
good. But I was watching one episode where they were talking about, they had some like biker gang dude, like an ex-gang member on there with a biker, and he was talking about how they would specifically like try to find ex-military people or people who were in the military, or they were sending the youngest gang members to join the military just to learn, like...
I remember that episode.
...tactics and, like, battle tactics. So...
Holy shit.
When they come back, they can, like, actually fight against other gangs, like, better than, like, what street gangs would do.
I think one of the episodes, they did it on, like, how there was, like... Never mind, I don't want to talk about it, because I don't want to start beef. I'm kind of scared.
Yeah, I was gonna say, if we do ever cover any like active gangs, we got to be very careful about that.
I get some.
I mean, like, Battle already covered MS-13 already.
I did cover MS-13, and I am so terrified. I mean, I'm not saying anything like.
We're just talking about
just
it.
Facts.
Like, yeah, it's facts about like.
I doubt that MS-13 is listening.
Well, that's the thing too, is that I wanted like this.
Or are
they? Researching this case makes me want to like go over like gangs as a whole. Because, like, just, like, with the history of some of it, I mean, I don't know. Because I know, like, in part, gangs were formed because they were protecting themselves and their communities, which were marginalized from the fucking police. Or,
that's
like,
what MS-13 was.
Yeah.
I think it was, like, Salvadoran?
I think so. It's interesting, too, because going through some of this stuff, it's, like, all these, like... Because a lot of gangs originate, obviously, in L.A., and end up in other places. So, like, there are some gangs that started in L.A. that ended up in Honduras or El Salvador or Mexico. Which, yeah. I would have thought it... I don't know. Anyway.
I mean, well, and onto the East Coast, which in some cases is even further than, you know, like Mexico, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the fact that there are, like, Bloods and Crips in New York.
Yeah. In Minnesota. Yeah,
that's a big jump.
There's Bloods and Crips everywhere. Yeah. I know Bloods.
Yeah.
But yeah, in an article from the LA Times, it said about Johnson in, quote, in 1994, Gloria Lyons told authorities that she saw an 89 family member kill a man. She was killed. Georgia Denise Jones testified in the same case. She was killed. 2 years earlier, Albert Sutton, it says in the Loggins and Baroque murders, which that's what actually got Cleman Johnson in San Quentin death row on death row. And because so in that specific case, he had a member that he was trying to initiate named Michael Allen, and he gave that man a weapon to go kill these two men who were just sitting in their car and had nothing to do with it. I mean, there's contentious case or evidence that, like, maybe Peyton Barreau was a Crip, but I've seen things that say both that he was and was not. But back to the quote. Detectives latched onto a witness, Freddie Jelks, who was facing life in prison for a murder. During the Loggins Barreau murder trial, Jelks said that evil had ordered the killings. The jury voted to convict and sent Johnson to San Quentin's death row. So, like, that's just in that, like, that's three different witnesses who were murdered in the process of, like, testifying against him. He even had ordered the death of the homicide detective that was investigating him, named Detective Thomas Matthew. Any relation? Just kidding. He only has one T. but yeah. Yes. Yes. But, yeah, so... and the two people that he actually was officially convicted of killing was Donald Loggins and Peyton Barreau. And it wasn't so much that he killed them, but that he instructed someone else to kill them. And then, so that, he was convicted of their murders in December of 1997. In 2011, the case was not overturned, but his conviction was, and they're supposed to be retrying him for those two murders as well as three more murders and then another attempted murder. But it keeps getting pushed back. So it was supposed to go to trial in 2016. And the last thing I read of it, which was reported on in 2019, they still haven't gone to trial, especially with the moratorium on the death penalty currently in California, especially LA County. So he's still kind of sitting on trial, which is moratorium on the death penalty. So a moratorium is like a hold. So it's not like they're not banning the death penalty wholesale, but right now they're not supposed to be convicting anyone to the death penalty, and anybody who is on death row, like, can't be executed right now. Essentially, it's like the whole thing right now with the moratorium on evictions. People cannot be evicted right now. The thing that's interesting is when he was 30 years old in 97, he was interviewed about all of this trial stuff and, like, all the things that he had done. And the interviewer asked him, like, well, because he said he wasn't worried about getting the death penalty, and he wasn't worried about being in San Quentin. And the interviewer asked him why, and he said, because he said that he's been in worse places. And he said, the places he had been that were worse were in an alley with a .45 pointed at me too many times, but I'm a survivor. I just turned 30. I never thought I'd make it to 20. After I got to the death penalty, I celebrated in jail with some homemade brew. I know I'm going to be around for at least 10 more years with all the appeals. Getting the death penalty saved my life. And I mean, if you think about it, he's right. Because that was 97. I mean, and it's now not quite, like, 25 years later. Plus, he's in his 50s. So he's been in jail this whole time, which if he hadn't been, he probably would be dead by now. Yeah, because that's the other thing that he said about it, where he was saying how it's like quote, like, it's like people going to Vietnam and getting programmed to kill. They can't stop killing. And when they come back, they need help mentally. We couldn't stop killing. Our enemies here either. I was one of them sick individuals. They locked us away, but we needed help mentally. Which is really interesting and insightful because, like, I agree. Like, yeah. Because, I mean, it's like, how much of that is a product of, like, your environment that you grow up in? You know, like, yeah. You're... Because that, and that was part of his defense, is that he is a product of his geography. Which, like... Apparently, gang violence has gotten a lot better out there in the past 20 years. But, like, the thing is, it's like they've never... I mean, obviously, we know with everything happening last year and now that, like, it's not so much that they're helping the communities. It's just that policing has gotten more, I guess... I don't want to say adept, but, like, I don't know.
Aggressive, maybe.
Yeah.
Well, and, like, if we look at, like, Africa, the re-education of child soldiers is, like, a big push for a lot of people. Because you have, you know, children, like, as young as, like, 8 who are committing war crimes. And then once their warlord dies, if they aren't killed in retribution by, like, local people, what is that child supposed to do now? They, like... So there are organizations that try to re-educate child soldiers and, like, reintegrate them into society. You know, like, one, get them off whatever drug that they were forced to be addicted to.
And yeah.
Try to get them mental health help through the trauma of, you know, being in war and committing murder.
Yeah, it's just crazy because, too, like, I mean, especially here, it's all such this whole idea of, like, personal responsibility. And, I mean, yes, there is a lot of personal responsibility for, like, the choices that we make, but at the same time, like, yeah, like...
If you don't got the tools to make those choices, you don't got the tools. And if you never were never given those tools from the jump, you kind of already at a disadvantage. So it was like, I moved to Jersey when I was, like, 15. And then, like, seeing how, like, how I grew up, like, moving from the inner city of Philly to the suburbs, to see, like, how my cousins and, like, other family members grew up who were still in that area, it's like...
Yeah, it's crazy.
And it's literally just based on where you live at and, like, how your life can just pan
out. It's, you know, privileged people not recognizing, saying, like, oh, I would never make that decision, I would never make that choice. Like, okay, you were never in an environment where that choice would have to be made.
Because you don't have to.
But I can think, like, oh, well, if I was still in Philly at, like, 16, I'd probably be running the streets, too. Because, like, all my friends and everybody's out in the streets. What was the
distance? I'm the nerd. But, yeah, it's just, like, it's really interesting, cause, like, all the different factors that, like, come into things like this. Like, the other thing that, like... Another of the rabbit holes that I fell down when I was researching this is that there is this entire article about how one of the detectives that was investigating Johnson and is, like, had been working on the case, like, while he's been in jail for the prosecution, was quoted. He went, like, out. The detective went out with, like, other people in the district attorney's office, like, to a, like, a bar or a restaurant or whatever, and he said something to the effect of, like, sorry, let me find it real quick. He said something to the effect of, I was out there with those N-words, they call themselves that. And the other people sitting there were like, whoa, hey. It took them a long time too, because of course, but eventually the prosecutor did, like, report that incident. And so, like, it
was
had
it,
to
was
be
it a hard R or like a soft R?
Oh, it was a hard R.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Oh, mask off.
So he put that in, like, as part of the case, because it's supposed to establish essentially that the government officials are not necessarily reliable or good witnesses.
Yeah, that biases exist in that.
Exactly. Which kills me because there are multiple times where the district attorney's office, like, defends what he said. As far as, like, okay, it says here, quote, a prosecutor with the unit at the time concluded that McCartan had been referring specifically to gang members and that the use of the slur, taken in proper context, does not provide circumstantial evidence that he is biased against African Americans.
I beg the fuck.
Make it make sense. Yeah, like, I just... It's just, yeah. And then they tried to say, well, he's not racist against all black people. He's just racist against gang members. At least that was my interpretation of it.
Well, so. You're going to be overseeing cases involving gang members who may be innocent.
Mm-hmm. This is not the
case. So...
Yeah. Yeah, he was, he did leave the force, but he left with a six-figure, payout and a pension.
Nice.
Hate to see it.
Well, I'm glad the guy's on death row, though. At least, I'm glad that he has life sentence.
Or with death row, yeah.
That he's not continuing to...
Well, again, they still have to retry him. So, like, I don't know how it will turn out. I feel like with the way California is going, they might get rid of the death penalty. I don't know. That's just my guess. But it obviously it's not going to happen anytime soon, so.
Well, I mean, if there's any way to, like, leverage him as a resource to, like, stop children from joining gangs...
Yeah, like, make him fucking motivational speaker or some shit. And on that note, we're going to take a small break.
And now, a short commercial break.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
All right, so mine also has a very upsetting name. And a more just upsetting and... I never actually read a case like this before, and I didn't know what I'm about to talk about was a thing, but I guess it is. So now, Brandon Thomer was known as the West Side Rapist, or as someone in a Reddit comment section said, the Old Lady Strangler, which I feel like is a more appropriate name. So he was found to be guilty of 12 murders of elderly women specifically, and was sentenced to life in prison. So now, it has been on the record that Brandon did not have a good upbringing whatsoever. There isn't a lot of information on his background at all, other than from his accounts and, like, family and friends. But even that, they still didn't really, like, tell a lot. But we do know that he was, like, abused in certain ways. And this could have led to him, you know, being a serial killer. So... And since 1960, Brandon has been repeatedly arrested for various offenses over the, like, next couple of decades up until his first murder. He spent several years in a juvie and was subjected to physical and sexual abuse by other teenagers in the facility, which, on top of already having a bad childhood, can only just add to mental illness, to say the least. So because of this continuous abuse, he did develop a mental disorder and began showing signs of paraphilia. And paraphilia is the sexual attraction to atypical objects. So things people normally wouldn't be sexually attracted to or turned on by, he became sexually attracted to and turned on by. So now, after being abused by family members, Brandon left his home to live on the streets where he was forced to live a lifestyle that he couldn't escape. In the 1970s, Brandon moved to LA, where he first showed signs of
I can't. I fuck up with my G's all the time. Gentrophilia. I'm pronouncing. I fuck up.
Gentrophilia. Mean like is that like? It's like geriatric.
Yes.
So gentro.
I can't. I mess up my G's a lot. But yeah, that is a sexually attraction. That's a sexual attraction to elderly people. He was sexually attracted to elderly women. Brandon was arrested in 1975 for assaulting and raping his first victim, who was an elderly woman. Brandon was sent off to a state hospital after being declared insane and was released in June of 1979. So he spent about 4 years in his mental hospital for rape and assault and got out. I don't know why. I feel like a rapist should get more than just 4 years. They gotta make sure they don't reoffend.
They still don't.
Yeah.
They still don't. Yeah, no, they get. We're too laxed on rapists.
Especially in the 70s.
Yeah. So now, after his release, he actually sought to build his career as a musician. He did have, you know, his own hopes and dreams outside of raping old people. He also tried to get a job and just build up some, like, soft skills as a labor worker. In 1983, Brandon became the prime suspect for murders of two elderly women. It was not until he was caught trying to break into a house of a paraplegic 85-year-old woman was he arrested. Following the arrest, they actually searched his apartment and found over 200 pieces of jewelry, photographs, watches, and other small items that could be identified to over 34 elderly women who had died or been assaulted between 1981 and 1983. So, you know, they found he was guilty for 12, but he estimated he assaulted or interacted with like around like 35 women, but some couldn't come forward, some that died afterwards. It was a whole thing. So he could be.
That is.
Yeah, so. We can confirm he murdered 12, but the number could be higher than that because, like, he's linked to 35 other people. So the trial began early 1986. In addition to physical evidence, fingerprints that belonged to him on the crime scenes, the prosecutor was also presented with 100 witnesses. A number of Brandon's friends, family members, and acquaintances stated on his behalf that he had already shown signs of gentrophilia from a young age. And he also tried to assault two elderly women at a supermarket where his girlfriend worked, which is also very bold of him to do. Yeah. So he and that when it comes to that incident, he also spent all this free time there too. So it was kind of just like a hunting ground for him because it's also suspected that's where he like ran into a lot of his victims. Like, he would hang out at the supermarket, see an elderly woman and kind of just like stalk them until he like makes his move.
That's kind of scary.
Oh, it's terrible.
Like, could you imagine minding your own business,
getting like your fucking milk,
not realizing that you're being stalked? Like, stalking makes me nervous too. I think that's my second biggest fear besides going missing, like being stalked and not knowing. Because like, it's like you. I think that's why I like the show You so much, because like, oh my gosh, right?
I'd rather go missing than be stalked.
Yeah, if I had to pick up, I'd rather go missing. Or at least, like, I don't want to know that I'm being stalked.
Yeah.
So now, to continue, some of them also told the court that he periodically would find temporary work in the evenings or nights that would, the jobs that he had also coalesced to where like the victims were in their locations. So he would stalk to the point to where as though he would actually work near where his victims were staying or were at, just to be closer to them, to like,
surprised he didn't work in hospice.
Right?
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
That would have been bad. So now Brandon himself couldn't explain like why he had this attraction to elderly women. He couldn't explain why he did it. He couldn't give an alibi, and he couldn't give any type of defense for himself. So ultimately, in July 1986, Brandon was convicted of all charges brought against him. In July of 1986, he was charged and sentenced to life in prison, and he wasn't going to get death at first, but his defense attorney emphasized that his life and like his upbringing really led him down this path, and he's like basically a victim of circumstances and of his own mental illness, and that's what helped stay him from death penalty into getting several life convictions consecutively without parole. He is still alive now at 71. He was moved from his initial prison to a hospital due to severe medical issues. Yeah, he's still well and alive and just hanging out at 71. No one's ever tried to interview and talk to him since. So, yeah, that is.
And he's not going for any appeals, just like waiting out the clock.
Waiting out the clock.
Huh. I'm glad he's off the street.
Yeah.
Just talking.
Because during the trial, and again, even with the trial, there wasn't a lot of information out there on it, but from all I could see, he really just didn't have any type of. He didn't even try to make an excuse. He's kind of just like, yeah, oh, you got me. And it let his lawyer just do all the talking for him. And again, there was no excuse. It's just, you did what you did, you're going to jail because you're a monster.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was my case on the old lady strangler from a Reddit post I saw.
I don't like the idea of people looking at other people as prey. I mean, get it. It happens all the time, but like...
I think that's like the majority of the...
I was gonna say, even just like in the casual, like when people are like going out to meet up with people or like trying to hook up with people at like bars and stuff, like the way they talk about like hooking up is always just like a little off.
Oh yeah,
it's like the whole like pickup artist.
Oh, I want her.
Oh yeah.
If you go on YouTube and just watch pickup artist videos, they can be really funny if you're drunk enough. Because like, damn, people really are down bad. Like, bro, just talk to somebody. I get it, it's rough, but don't listen to these assholes.
Like, yeah. There's no like magic little hand wavy trick that'll just convince people that you're attractive.
There ain't.
If you're mean to a pretty girl, then she'll want to have sex with you.
You gotta, you gotta stand by ABB. Always be berating.
Yeah.
Sorry, it's the golden rules. But go ahead, Battle. Take it away.
Yeah, don't be stalkers, people. But anyway, it's me, Battle. If you didn't know. I think everyone
I did.
Knew.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Lawrence.
Oh, that's a terrible name. I hate my first name. So I am talking about the Tacoma Axe Killer. I like that they all had names. But yeah, before we talk about the Tacoma Axe Killer, I'm going to talk a little bit about serial killers because I think it's super interesting and informative, maybe. Yeah, it's informative. It's information that you may have known. You listen to true crime podcasts, so I'm assuming you know a little bit about serial killers. But if you didn't, according to the FBI, in order to be classified as a serial killer, you, one, must have killed three or more people, not less of one of which was committed within the United States, having common characteristics. So they happen, well, here in the United
Only
States.
Only serial killers are here.
We're talking about here in, like, the United States. So,
and I'm not that dumb, I promise.
I am, but I read it so many times. So, they also have common characteristics such as to suggest the reasonable possibilities that these crimes are connected by the same actor or actors, so the same person or group of people. And if you think about the different serial killers that we've talked about on the podcast or from other places, this would stand true. Another thing that the FBI talks about is about causality and the serial murderer, which in the definition that the FBI uses, causality is defined as a complex process based on biological, social, and environmental factors. And in addition to these factors, individuals have the ability to choose to engage in certain behaviors. And you might think, okay, what type of behaviors? Because most behavior is normal, right? Like if we go down the street right now, I think we have an idea of what is normal behavior. If we see something out of the norm, and I'm using that in air quotes, out of the norm, we'd be like, what the fuck is this person doing? Or why is this person acting this way? Think about it. Like, we go every single day walking around and we don't bat an eye about what's happening around us because we view certain things as normal behavior. Unless someone pops...
Or, like me, mind your business.
I do understand, though, because defining normal is very subjective, and normal to me, or just like Andre said, mind your business, normal to Andre is not normal to you, everyone. But I just think there are some innate, inalienable human normalcy that we experience. We can kind of distinguish what's normal and not.
Right. Well, and like the community you're growing up in defines those things. So like those, like that one kid who doesn't fit in with their local community is going to be branded as weird for some reason.
Right.
You know, whatever it ends up being.
Right. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, some things are wrong, or some things are right and wrong. However, we don't all see it this way, depending on where or how you're raised. So this idea behind causality in the serial murderer or serial killer, we have these kinds of questions like, what makes a person become a serial killer? And this goes back to causality, meaning their upbringing, biological factors, and the choices that they make throughout their lives that form them into being a serial killer or serial murderer. And this is a really dense discussion, I get it, and we could continue this on a different day. I really like the idea of doing something on serial killers, even though there's a lot of information and there's a lot of documentaries that have talked about it. It's just very interesting on serial killers. So.
Yeah, I think we should do that, I was talking about how, like, the difference between, like, my case and Robert's case. These people killed more than 3 people, but they wouldn't be classified as serial killers. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
probably not.
Right, because it's like they didn't physically do the act. That's why they say that's why the FBI uses it as the same actor or actors, because it kind of like lumps people in depending on how it's done.
And motivation makes a difference too, because like these people are killing people in like retaliation or because of circumstance, whereas like I feel like serial killers kill people just because they enjoy it.
Yeah,
just different.
And yeah, like the opposite.
If we think of like the Iceman, he was a mob hitman, mm-hmm. who was also a serial killer, but you know, because he had killings like outside of his like role as a hitman, he like suddenly becomes a serial killer. I don't know if like all hitmen would fall into that category.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I would say they're
serial killer or not.
I don't know.
Maybe more like a more of a mass murderer type thing.
Well, see, it's like, yeah, kill for hire.
Well, but that's still like a reason to kill, right? Kill for hire. But okay, we gotta get back to the case.
I don't know.
Like, wait, let's talk.
We'll have to get a
secure that bag.
Yeah, I would love to have a discussion. Maybe this could be like a live stream that we do, because I like this conversation.
Philosophize.
Yeah. So, my case with the axe killer, the Tacoma axe killer, one thing I did find interesting about this case was that the Tacoma axe killer actually changed how criminologists thought of serial killers and how they chose their victims, because throughout different studies of crime, especially surrounding serial killers tend to stay within their own race. And I was reading on crimemuseum.org that the serial killer's first victim is often a sex worker or a homeless person because of their status, and that's what their argument is, of the status is like, one, I think we need to normalize sex workers because it's sex. People have sex. You know, I don't think that they should be looked at lesser people. Same thing with homeless people who are homeless. They should not be looked at as lesser people, individuals. But this is how society looks at people
A good old meritocracy.
Yeah. So, and that's why they say that serial killers typically look at people who are valued as less than, in their eyes, as less than people who are worthy of being deemed of value. So, the Tacoma Axe Killer, however, defied of what we thought of as a serial killer, as he stalked and preyed upon white women in the 1940s. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah. So the Tacoma Axe Killer, whose real name is Jake Byrd, was born in Louisiana December 14th in 1901, and during his early life, he faced a lot of adversity, which makes sense because he was a black man in early 1900s.
So one thing that connects all these stories, everyone has a horrible upbringing.
Yes. And at the age of 19, he actually left his home. And he was considered a worker that never stayed in one place for too long. He liked to move around, and his work mostly consisted of working for the railroads, where he was able to make quick money for pretty tough labor and then move on to the next place wherever the railroad was going next. But moving from place to place meant that he would have the opportunity to do bad things, in his case, because that's what he did. Throughout his life, he was in trouble with the law a lot, and it was estimated that he served roughly 15 years throughout his life in prison for various crimes like burglaries, attempted assault, and attempted murder. And it wasn't until October 30th, 1947, when he was finally apprehended and stopped. And so, here's what happened. He was looking for work, he stumbled across someone's house. That someone was named Bertha Clunt. Bertha had a 17-year-old daughter named Beverly June. So Jake decides to break into her house and finds her purse and steals $1.50, which in our time, that's about $16 or $17. Wait, what?
$3.50.
Don't get that Loch Ness Monster, no 3.50. I hate all of you.
Goddamn Loch Ness Monster.
Excuse everyone. They do not know. Bless their hearts, right? No, I'm just kidding. That's terrible. And I can't stop thinking about Isaac Hayes. I was thinking, don't get that Loch Ness Monster, no 3.50. Okay, so according to SouthSoundTalk.com, there was an altercation inside the house because Bertha and Beverly were there when he decided to break in and steal that $150. Unfortunately for both of them, they were both brutally murdered and hacked apart by an axe that he had found in a nearby shed. Not so funny now. Yeah, that's what I thought. Neighbors called the police because they heard screams, and by the time they got there, Jake was running out of the house covered in blood. And he was able to actually run a block or two down the road before he was finally caught and apprehended. They investigated him talked to him, and he almost got away with brutally murdering these two people. And he just had the power of gab. He had a silver tongue. He could talk. He was hip to the jive. Let's just say that. But one thing kept him from getting away. It was one gruesome fact that
he was covered in blood.
No.
I was about to say
it was brain matter that was actually
hot, red handed.
Well, because like he was trying to like say that he didn't do it, and he was like defending himself or whatever, but he had brain matter on him. Like, he had brain matter on him. Like, it was, I guess, chunks of brain on him. So once in custody, Jake finally said, "Okay, yeah, man, I did it." Not in those exact words, of course.
Yeah, man, I did it, man.
He's like, look here. I don't know how they talked in the 1940s. That's how I assume they talked. So he just confessed, and he stated that it was a burglary gone wrong. You do not chop people up with a fucking axe if you are trying to burglarize someone else's. get dogs, people. If you don't want guns, like, just get dogs. I have three, and they will bite you.
Yeah, if you get, like, your house is broken into, just pick up your nearest dog and throw it.
Yes. I have a pit bull. What? He's such a cute pit bull.
Robert Durst of him, even though he came first.
So, fast forward a little bit into this case, which lasted, or the trial, which lasted only about a day and a half. He was actually found guilty of premeditated murder, and he got the death penalty. And the death penalty. And the death penalty then was hanging. And according to murderpedia.org, at the end of his sentencing, Jake was given time to make a statement, which lasted 20 minutes. And what he said, I want to summarize a part of it. He says, he said, I was given no chance to defend myself. My own lawyers just asked you to hang me. They apologized for defending me. If they were so reluctant to defend me, why did they test the prosecutor's proof of murder and now saying that everything is proven? Like, he pretty much was just like, why'd you guys even, like, prosecute me? Like, if you guys knew already I was guilty, like, what's the point? And no one was going to defend me. It was different back then. People were just like, never mind.
I don't understand a court system. Like, someone explain it to
me. Like, because...
how did I wind up here?
Right? Like, bro. Like, what do you mean? You had brain matter. You were covered in blood.
But explain to me why I had a lawyer if I already had brain on me.
Yeah, that's the thing. I was like, I mean, yeah. But also, like, your lawyer is fucking apologizing for defending you.
Like, I am so sorry that I have to defend this guy. Like,
listen, a check is a check. I got
business. So, at the end of the 20-minute remarks that he made, he declared, all of you guys that had anything to do with this case are going to die before I do, which later became the name of the Bird Hex. And guess what happened within a year to five of the five men connected with the trial?
Wait, it took a year for him to hang?
Yeah.
Was it a strong
within a year, no. They hanged him pretty quick, but within a year, five men died. Five men that were connected to his trial died. Judge Edward Hodge had a heart attack within a month of giving him the death sentence. One of the police officers who took his first confession, a police officer who took his second confession, the court's chief clerk, a prison guard, and a year and a half later, the lawyer that sentenced him also died. So, his sentence was supposed to happen January 16th, 1948, but Jake said he had killed 44 other people, which was going to help police solve the case. So, of course, the judge gave him a 60-day reprieve, meaning they just put the death sentence on hold for him. They just postponed the execution date. And according to Wikipedia, Jake was interviewed by state officials, and 11 of the murders were substantiated, so were actually proven. Yeah, he did it. According to him, he killed people in Florida, Illinois, Iowa, Kansas, Kentucky, Michigan, Nebraska, Ohio, Oklahoma, South Dakota, and Wisconsin.
How the fuck was he getting around?
Remember his job? He was a transient worker, so he would work for the railroad, and like then the railroad was still being established here in the United States, so he was able to travel and, like I said, do bad things. And
yes, murder is bad. I agree.
Another thing.
That
was the curse, because like he didn't hire anyone to do it. They all died of like natural causes, but it was just very quickly. Yeah, it was coincidental. Yeah, they coincidentally died. And another, again, I want to point out, each of his victims were white women. And he killed them with an axe or a hatchet, which in his story, he said that he found that hatchet in a certain spot, like in some random shed. And eventually, July 15th, 1949, the Tacoma axe killer, Jake Bird, was finally executed with 125 witnesses. So he was publicly lynched. And that's my case, everyone.
I mean, honestly, It's surprising he, like, lasted that long.
Yeah, like, took him 10 years.
Because he was even arrested a few times for, like, burglary and stuff, and, like, in that era.
Pick him up, the shoes already.
Well, I don't think they're, like, if you think about it, back then, the justice system, I don't think, was super intertwined, so everything was, like, snail mail.
Yeah. Well, that's the whole thing. It was still like that in the 70s, which is why it took them so long to convict Ted Bundy.
Yeah.
Because they
just weren't talking to each other.
Different jurisdictions, it's really difficult. But yeah, this one was a wild one. I didn't think that it was going to be as intense. Like, it has a serial killer, but also has the almost paranormal aspect of, like, the bird hex, which you could read about. It was just like there's all these conspiracies about what he was doing and him being a Satanist, even though I know plenty of Satanists that don't like, it's not about black magic, it's about removing the god and treating people with dignity and respect. There you go, Andre. Wow, kiss him on the lips. His mustache, our mustache, gets tied into each other's mustache.
Oh, I guess we all need to have a mustache now.
Put it up against the
sun. Yeah, I'll just, like, touch mustaches. But yeah, that's my case. It was fun.
We actually all kind of had some, like, witness tampering.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, part for the chorus. And it's funny, every
violence against
battle, every time you said the word H-E-X, my cat ears perked up.
Aww.
She just kept looking over like, who's speaking to me?
If you didn't know, I used to think Hexy was Lexi.
I just let him keep saying it until I got annoyed one day.
Yeah, I didn't know. And he got so mad at me. Before an episode, he, like, flipped out on me. He's like, why do you keep calling her that? Her name is Hexy. And then he puts me on blast on Instagram.
Oh, I do remember that.
I'm just like, oh. I'm going to delete my Instagram.
But hey, that was our very informative episode on some serial killers, which we're just going to continue the rest of the month, so get ready for that shit. This was good. The cases were good. The mustaches were even better.
But yeah, I hope you guys enjoyed the episode today. I hope you all enjoyed the episode. There's going to be so many moments of silence for these people that are listening.
Well, no, that's why we have post-production. And I hope you enjoyed the music. While we adorn our mustaches, we will see you later.
Bye.
Bye.
Time now for your latest weather forecast.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Ooh.